Please be seated. This is the time and the place for the annual rules hearing of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The record may show that due notice has been given to the bar and public through notice in the State Bar Newsletter and other methods. We will proceed one proposal at a time, and the court's custom is to ask anybody who is in opposition to the proposal to speak first. It simply speeds up the process because then the proponents can hone in on those concerns and they don't have to just shotgun it. So with that explanation, we will go to the first proposed rule. It would amend SDCL 15-12-30 to eliminate triplicate filing and certified mail requirements. This is submitted by the State Court Administrator's Office after consultation with the Clerk's Advisory Council. Does anybody wish to speak in opposition to this? Okay. Anybody want to speak as a proponent? There being no comments, we will go to the next proposal. Number two, this would govern the filing of transcripts in the circuit court. It is a proposal submitted by the State Court Administrator's Office and intends to clarify the status of transcripts in light of electronic filing. And specifically, the State Court Administrator's Office also requests implementation of the rule effective March 1st, 2015. Does anybody wish to appear in opposition to this rule? Anybody want to speak on behalf of it? Mr. Sadazan.
May it please the court, Chief Justice, and with your permission, I would like to speak to rules 2, 3, 4, and 5. They all are actually kind of a package related to transcripts, and I think that might make my remarks quicker and much more concise. Essentially, what's happening here, and I just thought it important to give the court a little bit of background. Prior to electronic documents and e-filing, there was questions about the status of transcripts and how those are transmitted to the clerk's of court's office, who should have access to those documents, and how they relate. So this rule really was brought at the behest of the Court Reporters Committee. It's intended to clarify that period. It's modeled loosely after what they do in the federal court system. Really what's going to happen, someone requests the transcripts, copy goes electronically to the clerk. The court can request a hard copy if they determine it's appropriate, but we're moving toward the electronic documents, and so this would make sure the clerk has electronic copies. That document then essentially sits in the clerk's queue for 90 days and would be treated as sealed. During that 90-day time period, it allows the parties to review the transcripts to determine if anything in there needs to be redacted, if there's Social Security information, sensitive information, financial numbers, before access is then granted. The reason that review period, I think, is so important is because we're certainly moving toward, and a number of the rules we'll talk about today are moving toward electronic access, which means currently right now in the courthouses, there's a terminal to view all the documents filed. So after 90 days, these transcripts would be available to anyone that wanted to look. But we're also contemplating web-based access. And when you do that, obviously, the individuals that might access the data just compounds because you're going to have a large number of people that can access from remote locations. And so we think that 90-day period is important to require the parties, not the court reporter, to review the transcripts and make those decisions on what should or should not be publicly available.
Out of curiosity, why has March 15th date been selected? Is there a reason for that?
Primarily because that allows us to coincide with our dates for mandatory e-filing. And so we think sooner rather than later probably is the best answer. So that's kind of the date we picked.
Okay. Yep. Any questions for Mr. Sadazan from the bench? Okay, thank you, sir. I guess as a matter of clarity, I should also ask if there's any opponents to proposals 4 and 5, because I just referenced 3. Does anybody want to speak on 4 and 5? Okay. There being no further comments on that, we'll go to proposals. Mr. Sadazan, 6 and 7, are they together? They appear to be.
Chief Justice. May it please the court.
Well, wait a minute. Are you?
Oh, I'm the proponent of
okay,
these rules.
Okay. Does anybody want to oppose 6 and 7? Such eagerness. Okay, 6 and 7, Mr. Sadazan.
Again, this is intended to really make sure what information we're providing to the public is as protective as possible of people's personal privacy while still ensuring public access to the documents. And so as part of this kind of review of access to court records and contemplation of electronic access, we went through the court records rules and made some changes, and that's what this rule revision is based on, to protect medical account information, the same as we do other account information. And currently the way the rule is drafted, it only provides protection for things like Social Security numbers to the actual parties to the case. We think as we discuss this, it's just as important that if a Social Security number should somehow come out from another interested party, that information will also be protected. So I think that's a good change to the rule. And then another fairly significant change is adding that the names of minor children that are victims of crime are also either redacted or initials are only used, depending on the nature of the proceeding. What we heard as we started to discuss this rule with the clerks and contemplating electronic access, particularly if you think of web-based access to court documents, identifying a victim of an incest case, a rape case, a sexual abuse case, you know, essentially can re-victimize that person. And so we wanted to take steps to protect that information. It would still obviously be available to the parties pursuant to court order on motion of the parties for good cause. It could also be disclosed if there's some reason for it to be disclosed. But in general, we thought it was important to protect that information. I visited with the defense attorneys, lobbyists, and also the state's attorney's representative and discussed this. They did not present any objections to me, and obviously they're not here today, so I think that they support it. What we found as we talked about this is a lot of state's attorneys do this now, and they look for this information to redact in those documents, and so this would allow us to kind of formalize that policy, and it's not done that way everywhere, so it will allow some uniformity as well.
Okay, any questions?
Mr. Sadazan, will the language in proposed court rule number 6 cover children who have brought protection orders alleging that they have been victimized? It references adult criminal proceedings. Would this be broad enough to cover protection orders, which are civil proceedings? Oftentimes initials are used now, but not always.
Justice Kern, you make a good point. Right now, as written, it would not apply, would be my interpretation, because you're correct. Those are civil proceedings. I think it might be a very good change to add the protection orders as part of that. So I think that's a good point.
Okay. Any other questions from the bench for Mr. Sadazan? Not, thank you, sir. Probably don't want to go too far. Proposal number 8. This would recognize reality by authorizing 4 full-time magistrate judges for the 7th Circuit. Anybody want to oppose this? Okay, Mr. Sadazan.
Please, the court, Chief Justice, this proposal really just aligns our current number of magistrates with the ones that we have been authorized by the legislature. There was a recent addition in the 7th Circuit, and so this brings us into conformity.
All right. Thank you. Number 9 is an example with amend 16-16-6. It's proposed by the Board of Bar Examiners would recognize in certain situations a person who graduates from a foreign law school can sit for the South Dakota Bar. Anybody opposed to this? Anybody want to speak on its behalf? Okay. Number 10 would amend 16-16-12.1, and this would amend the admission without examination appears to add a reciprocity component. Does anybody wish to speak in opposition? Does anybody want to speak on behalf of it? If not, we'll go to number 11, which should amend 16-16-12.2, again referencing bar admissions and reciprocity. Does anybody want to speak against it? Be no speakers. How about for it? There being none, we'll go to number 12. This is a recommendation, request, proposal, if you will, of the Board of Bar Examiners. Does anybody want to speak on behalf of the, or in opposition to it? If not, does anybody want to speak on behalf of it? If not, then we would go to the proposals concerning the South Dakota Rules of Evidence. That has been filed by the court. It's fairly voluminous. And I guess you could either speak in general terms or you could speak to specific rule changes. Obviously, the court is going to take significant time to study these because it's voluminous and it's important. Does anybody want to speak in opposition? Does anybody want to speak in as a proponent? Okay. First off, thank you for coming, sir, because we have a few questions for you, too.
Front roll. May it please the court. Sure. Doug Decker, I am code counsel for the state of South Dakota. I work with the Code Commission. The Code Commission is the statutory body that oversees the publication of the code. And what I'm here to propose in the spirit of cooperation is take this opportunity for the amendments to the evidence code, to take this opportunity to renumber the evidence code to conform to the federal rules of evidence. If you're familiar with the pamphlet that West publishes that identifies the federal rules of evidence and corresponds it or conforms it to the South Dakota Code, I think this is an opportunity to make that change. And I'm here to offer that West Publishing is on board with this project. They've encouraged it. I've shared the idea with the members of the Code Commission. They're all in support of it. And everybody that I have talked to informally thinks its time has come. And with that in mind, you know, the principles that we would use to make this change is we would look back to the original rule back in 78, which adopted the federal rules of the rules of evidence, use the federal rules as the guideline. We would follow that template, so to speak, and then move forward. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, a couple of them. One of them I understand is that we have to submit rules to you by March 15th to get them in the pocket parts. Is that correct?
That complies with our publishing schedule. And the sooner the better. Although West is now aware of this project, so they're paying close attention to the changes, and that deadline still holds because of the publishing restraints.
Another issue that was raised by Justice Kern, which is interesting, say the court makes its changes and they send it up to you. When you get it into final format, is there a legal way for the court then to put that back out in the bar newsletter for comment from the bar before it goes into effect?
That may please the justice. That depends on the publishing time frame. Mm-hmm. We would like to be able to put this into the pocket parts, which come out July 1. Hence, the March 15th deadline can be fudged. We can move that up to June, but not very far beyond June 1st, March, April.
Okay,
May.
Say that, that issue aside, that we know we can't make that date. Is there a legal way for us to send rules that we've approved up to you or tentatively approved? Have you put it in format and then send it back to the bar for comment? Or by the time do they get to you, do they have to be officially approved by us and you simply do your work and they go into the code?
I think there's some way to accommodate that. If that happens where we miss our deadline for publishing into the pocket parts, West publishes a supplemental pamphlet. And we can publish in that supplemental pamphlet, although it won't be in the pocket part.
Sure.
Can you give an example of how it would look? When we talked about it, I said, well, what would it look like, the new
Well, it would follow if you've looked at the Uniform Commercial Code or the Probate Code, where it incorporates the articles in the numbering system, such as 57A-1-101. What we would propose to do with this idea is create a new chapter for the evidence code. It'd be 19-19, and then 101 would become, or the first section of 19, that formally 19-9-1 would become 19-19-101. We would incorporate the article references and the catch lines and subdivision headings from the Federal Rules of Evidence where it's appropriate. And it would all be in one chapter with articles broken out accordingly.
Would the article be the middle number?
Pardon?
Would the article be the middle number?
Yes.
So it'd be 19?
No, the article would not be the middle number. The article would be a heading. It would all be in chapter 19-19. Then, for example, the general provisions, Rule 101 through 106 would be 19-19, 101 through 106, with a heading that is the appropriate heading for Article 1. Then there would be a break, Article 2, judicial notice, okay, and so forth like that.
Okay. So in essence, it would look like the published Federal Rules of Evidence now.
Yes.
Well, I think that's a great idea because I remember when I first got out of law school, he passed the UCC with a numbering system that did not conform to the standard numbers, and you literally had to sit there and read an opinion with a table cross-referencing. It was very difficult to use. I know that the court now has kind of a middle-of-the-road approach where we cite the current citation, and then we put in parentheses FRE and whatever it is, but I think your suggestion is neater and cleaner. Anything else you'd like to share with us today or any other questions from the bench?
Yeah, it's like cooperation. We think it's an opportunity to take advantage of. Ever since I have been on the LRC staff as code counsel, when we shifted from Alan Smith and Mickey to West, it's been a project of the bar and evidence committee to get this done. Now's a chance to do it.
I thank you as well, because most attorneys, if not, let's just say the vast majority, just use the federal number in any way. So this will make it just easier.
And I think since West is also pushing this project, we should be able to have a rough draft of what the idea would be and be able to share that with, you know, the court and members of the bar, so that, you know, if we have dropped the ball in some way, you know, there will be an opportunity to fix it.
Would we have to wait for the final proposals before you could do a rough draft, just to show in concept what we're looking at?
I don't know the answer to that. Obviously, West publishes other codes, but now is their time to dedicate their time to South Dakota. And like I said, the editors at West have committed to the project, so we should be able to have something, you know, later. I can't give you a definite deadline at this time.
If we were to tell you that we're tentatively thinking about doing this, we'd like to see how it's going to look. Is that something that you would do in your office and could give back to us before we actually pass it, or is that something that you actually have to send to West and have them formatted? How does that work?
I think we could, Justice Zinner, I think we could format an example to show people, and using the current rules as the guide, and then it should be able to figure out how the new ones would fit in. So I think we can do a rough draft.
Of the whole thing?
Yes.
Mr. Barnett, a question for you. Assuming that the only way we could get this out to the bar membership timely would be to post it, I assume, on the state bar. You have internet access to the members. What would be the turnaround time from the time we gave you the documents to where you could distribute them by email or however you do it to the members of the bar, because we're looking at a March 15th deadline here. It doesn't leave a lot of time.
May it please the Court, Chief Justice Tom Barnett, representing the State Bar. The answer to your question is if LRC or Code Counsel provides it to us in digital format, I can have it out to 92% of my members within 2 hours.
Can't do better than that. Okay, that was my only question.
An hour and a half.
Well, he wants an hour and a half.
Chief Justice, is there's an irony, because when I was anticipating what I was going to say, and I was going to get up and support and encourage the court to have Code Counsel go forward with the renumbering system, I'm the same vintage as the Chief Justice. And so I learned the UCC, and then I studied with White and Summers, and Justice Wilbur, of course, was just 1 year behind me, but she did the same thing. And when we get out, and then you have a UCC question, private practice, you're sitting there with the cross-reference table trying to figure out what they did, and then a number of years later they made it all easy by going and changing the numbering system, which I don't know why they didn't do it initially. When I talked with Mr. Decker about this project, I thought it was a great idea, but I said, let me call the chair, Chris Hutton, who's been sharing evidence forever. And she was all excited and supportive. She said, this is a perfect opportunity. And she said, well, how will this work? And I said, I think that between West and Code Counsel, they can move very, very quickly. And as soon as they have the draft, the court can review that and make sure that it looks good. They can get it to us. I could post it on our website, and you could pick an arbitrary date, like you have 1 week to comment once we posted it, and I'd post it on our website and send an email, and I've got 94% of the email addresses of our members, and say, so you got 1 week to comment, and I think the only comments are going to be fantastic. And so I encourage the court to take Code Counsel's offer under consideration. I hope that you approve that, and I think that come July 1st, we're going to be in great shape. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any other questions for Mr. Barnett? Thank you, too, for coming. Any further comments on the proposal on the South Dakota Rules of Evidence? If not, this will complete the hearing. I believe that's all the proposals, is it not, Shirley?
No, there's a couple more.
There are? Okay, lucky we didn't walk off the bench.
135, page
61. Okay, we have a proposed court rule. Numbered 135? Okay. Proposal to clarify the award of earned discharge credit for any month when a probationer is incarcerated. Does anybody want to appear in opposition to this? If not, does anybody want to speak on behalf of it?
May it please the court. Greg Satizon, State Court Administrator. This rule is really intended to clarify and provide some certainty to our court service officers as it concerns earned discharge credit. As you may recall, every month a probationer is compliant with their conditions. They receive a credit of 30 days off the end of their probation term. And the rules and the discussion essentially from the creation of this program was that this is a credit that you earn. You just don't do good enough to get it. You have to earn this credit. And what we found is that the way the rule was originally structured, it provided that if you were incarcerated as part of the sentence, so if your sentence was 30 days in jail and then you're on probation, that first 30 days, you can't earn a credit while you're incarcerated. We expect you to be compliant during that time. You're not showing us you can be supervised in the community. In addition, court service officers have the ability to sanction, which includes up to 48 hours in jail. And so if a sanction reaches a certain point on the sanctioning incentive grid, that essentially triggers an automatic loss of the credit. There's been healthy amount of debate amongst particularly the defense bar about how this is applied. And where it really is highlighted is you have a probationer who goes in and does a 24/7 test and is incarcerated because they failed the test. Or they're arrested on a new charge, there's some sort of a bond violation. There's all kinds of ways someone can get themselves in jail during that month without it being as part of the criminal sentence for that probation case or a part of a sanction by that probation officer supervising that probation case. And we, as we discussed this, really thought it made sense. If at some point during that month you find yourself incarcerated, you probably have not lived up to the expectations. And so I think it just really makes the rule a lot cleaner. It provides much more certainty for the court service officer to determine if the credit should be awarded. And when a person is denied a credit, there's a administrative appeal process that they can go through to challenge it. And this has been the area where we found challenges, where it was not technically a sanction from the court service officer or part of the sentence. And the court service officers had to make a judgment call, you know, looking at the conduct that led them to being incarcerated versus, you know, a very clean-cut answer, you were incarcerated this month, you lose the credit. I don't think that's too much to ask of our probationers, and so that's what prompted this change. It came about through concerns as we monitored. The implementation of Senate Bill 70 was recommended by our Chief Court Service Officers and Division of Trial Court Services.
Okay, any questions for Mr. Satterzan on 135? All right, then the next one would be Proposal 136. Anybody want to speak in opposition to this? This is a proposal by Presiding Judge Jeff Davis, who chairs the Presiding Judges Council, and all other presiding judges join in the recommendation. Anybody want to speak in opposition? How about on behalf of Ms. Starkappas?
Good morning. May it please the court. This proposal, or these proposed forms, were brought to you by the presiding Jeff Davis, presiding Judge Jeff Davis, with the approval of all the presiding judges. It was determined early on that every circuit was using their own independent forms when it came to e-warrants, and so the thought behind this was that we designed some uniform forms that would provide some consistency and efficiency for both the judges and the law enforcement officers. They are currently being used in the 4th and the 7th Judicial Circuits with some success. And I have reviewed the AG's comments in regards to these and have spoken with Ms. Archer, and we agree with a lot of their recommendations, and so we're going to work with them and get a final draft back to you.
So you would ask us not to act on the proposal today. We're going to see an amended proposal?
Correct.
All right. Okay, does anybody else want to speak on 136?
Well, I have a question. I didn't know that the rule was clear. This is a form or proposed form. This doesn't keep state's attorney or law enforcement from using another form if they choose.
Correct.
Okay. So we aren't dictating that they have to use this particular form.
Correct.
Okay.
These are supplemental in nature and won't replace anything else.
So we're simply approving these forms, and if they want to use another form, so be it.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions for Ms. Starkappas? Not? Thank you.
Thank you.
Proposal 137 is to adopt a risk assessment instrument in regards to the JDAI risk assessment instrument. It is submitted by the State Court Administrator's Office and has been approved by the presiding judges. Does anybody want to speak in opposition to this? Anybody want to speak on its behalf? Ms. Starkappas.
May it please the court. The risk assessment instrument is an assessment tool that's used by the appointed intake staff across the state, and it's designed to ensure that juveniles are screened and treated consistently across the state. This tool determines whether the juveniles are appropriate for release, appropriate for referral to another detention facility or an alternative to detention, or whether a secure detention facility is appropriate under the circumstances while they're awaiting a court hearing. The only addition that we ask is that the implementation date was originally April 1st, and I think the state court administrator's office was a little optimistic, and when we looked at the training that is going to be required associated with this tool, we'd like to back that off to June 1st.
Okay. Continuity's sake, most things go into effect July 1st. Would that be okay, or do you want June 1st?
That is fine with me.
July 1st is okay?
Yes.
All right. Okay. Any questions from the bench for Ms. Starkiapis on Proposal 137?
Are all of the presiding judges in agreement with this rule?
Yes.
Any other questions for Ms. Starkiapis?
Okay. On the numbers and the tabulation, were they developed? Where were they developed?
What was that?
Well, this gives certain points as I read it, and then it's scored. Where was this evidence-based process from somewhere, some company, someone who's... Where did it come from?
It comes from the JDAI standards and rules.
Where did they get it?
That's a good question.
Is there evidence base behind this?
Yes,
was it
yes.
tested?
Yes, it is evidence based.
This is the form that Sioux Falls and Rapid City have been using for some time, isn't it?
Correct.
Okay, and they basically invented the program before we even got involved.
Right.
Okay.
It's been in consultation with the Annie E. Casey Foundation, which has vetted it nationally.
Yes.
And it is an evidence based proposal.
Okay. Yes, thank you.
All right. Anything further you wish to say, counsel?
No, thank you.
All right. Any further questions for her? If not, surely that would cover it, correct?
Yes.
All right. The court will be in recess to consider the proposals. And thank you all for coming today and sharing your comments with us. We are in recess.